Welcome to Le Podcast on Emerging Leadership. I'm your host, Alexis Monville. In this episode, we are excited to welcome Michael Galloway, a visionary leader in the tech industry with over 2 decades of experience. Currently shaping the future of cloud infrastructure at SashiCorp, Michael brings a wealth of knowledge from his dynamic roles at companies like Yahoo and Netflix. Today, he shares his journey, insights on platform engineering, and the evolving landscape of technology leadership. Welcome to the podcast on emerging leadership, Michael. How do you typically introduce yourself to someone you just met?
Yes, thank you for inviting me, Alexis. The way I think I typically introduce myself is, I live in California. I've been working in the tech industry for about 20 years. A father of two rambunctious girls and husband to a wife of almost 20 years now.
Wow, wow, wow. I would love to unpack all those things, but maybe we'll have time for some of it. Let's look at your journey in the tech industry. Fascinating journey. I've heard about your experiences both at Netflix and now at SashiCorp. Could you give us a snapshot of your career trajectory and what drew you to that field of cloud infrastructure?
Sure. Well, like I mentioned, I've been in the industry for more than 20 years. I was actually part of the early 2000s crew at Yahoo, just before the Google IPO. So that was an interesting experience to start off my career.
I can imagine.
That was, everything was possible. And some of the most brilliant minds that I have the opportunity to work with many years later in my started there. In fact, my current boss at HashiCorp was also part of that crew back at Yahoo. And it's the valley is ultimately very small. From Yahoo, I went through a number of different ranges of companies. So I actually did a startup in the enterprise software space, which I was fortunate to sell. I would say it's more of an acqui-hire, but it was a great experience to go through what is a startup life like in Silicon Valley. Eventually, I landed at Netflix around 2016 and moved into the platform engineering organization. From there, I led a bunch of teams in delivery engineering. I think the most famous part of Netflix that people may know of is the Spinnaker product that was developed for the most part between Netflix and Google. And that's what we evolved and worked on. After that, that was really where I fell in love with platform engineering as a concept. The whole concept of full cycle development and DevOps as we were pioneering it at Netflix was just fascinating. And working with some of the greatest minds, I've had the opportunity to work in the space. I eventually moved to leading platform organizations at mid-tier companies, and now I'm over at HashiCorp running the infrastructure part of the organization. Personally, you asked about infrastructure. Infrastructure specifically is a fascinating and evolving space. You know, I actually have experience going in front of David Filo, one of the founders of Yahoo, and making physical hardware requests. I remember standing in line. A little anecdote there is, we all queued up at these hardware request committee meetings. David Filo is one of several members. And I was right behind this gentleman. I had just started my job. Maybe I was a month, 2 months in. And the person in front of me was from Yahoo Photos. And he goes up to David Filo. And he's making requests for several multi-million dollar filer machines that we needed for the Yahoo Photo footprint. And they discussed and we'll ultimately approve. And then my number is called and I get up and I said, I'm looking for $300 to buy a hard drive for one of our machines. And Philo had this look on his face of like, yeah, maybe we can do some efficiency improvements for this meeting. This might not be the best use of everybody's time. And I say, I really appreciated that he saw it that way. But, I think a lot of us have experience with the actual tin, but with the introduction of virtualization that really came out many years later, unlocked, all kinds of capabilities like, immutable deployment pattern and real ephemeral infrastructure started to become a thing. And finally, I think, so what we're seeing is the outcome of those innovations and this idea that you can allocate virtual global infrastructure in minutes. But I truly think that that's actually just the beginning of where we're headed as an industry. So it's an exciting space to be.
Oh, wait. That's very interesting because, yeah, with the introduction of virtualization, basically, a lot of people thought, you don't need to care really about cloud infrastructure anymore. And if, anyway, everything will be fine. That's just infrastructure as code, and let's do everything. But that's not really what happened. Even if I don't remember DevOps, it's what, 2009, something like that? We are still not there yet completely. During your talk at Plateau Elevate, you mentioned that Cloud Infra was not about hiding complexities, but setting the right defaults. I would like you to discuss that a little bit more, because that will maybe tell us what is coming, what the future looks like.
Yeah, this is a very fascinating conversation. It's something that we can quickly get into modern applications and lose a sense of principles. So I like to come at this more from a principles first approach than just, you know, the common conversation that I hear in many platform organizations or many companies is should we present a Heroku environment? And I think that's missing some grounding. You're talking about how to use it as opposed to the philosophies of behavior that you want to encourage or support in an organization. So like everything else in software development, the answer is maybe. The answer is nuanced, right? But let's start with I'll give you an early story that really grounded my thinking on this. It goes back to my Yahoo days, actually. So I was a software engineer there, and I worked on the Confabulator product. It was a desktop widgets product that worked on both Mac and Windows, actually the modern Apple widgets experience on the iPhones, as well as Netflix's TV or Netflix's video capabilities on TV and all the modern TV widgets, all are actually born from some of the actual same humans that worked on Confabulator. I actually worked with some of those guys. One of them I actually hired into Yahoo. So just a little short history there. So all things are connected. But I was working on this, and I was around much smarter minds than mine. And one of the lead engineers in the group emphasized to me, he said, don't just use the interfaces to these libraries that are, you know, available to us from the TVs or from the OS systems that we're trying to operate on. Don't just use the interfaces. He said, you need to understand what they do underneath. You need to understand those in order for you to be able to solve the real problems, the hard problems. And he was right. How often we end up grabbing a library and just using it without thought of how is it actually performing these actions? And when you do that, and we've seen this in software development all the time, where you have higher and higher level frameworks, and the understanding of the magic underneath is ultimately limited to the few that actually care to try to introspect. And some of those frameworks actually actively try to encapsulate and block the ability for you to really understand what's under the covers. Why does that matter? Is because if it fails to do the thing I need it to do, if my application calls into an interface, and for whatever reason, that interface has an unexpected side effect, I now have no ability other than to just abandon that interface to solve that problem. And that becomes really a limiting factor. So if you take it from that perspective, and you view software platforms, and you view infrastructure platforms or platform engineering platforms are all the same concept, right? They're encapsulation, they're abstraction, there's the same software principles. You start to get to the point where you realize, where do you want to put the responsibility for resolving and solving problems? In a true DevOps world, you ideally want to enable application teams to ultimately have the ability to understand and operate their products in production. Mm-hmm. And if you don't enable them to be able to see below the detail for how something is being done, they have no ability to perform that task. They have to rely on a central team to do it. Just like if I am the provider of a framework, but they can never see into the code of that framework, if that framework fails to do the thing they need to do, they're going to abandon it or do something different, which will create heterogeneity in the environment and more complexity. So when I think about the right experience, what I look at is not about hiding the complexity per se. I think you can follow abstraction or present an interface facade if you want to simplify the 0-to-1 problem that most of the time this is what they're talking about. I just want to get my application up. I just want to get a database. That's a 0-to-1 problem. Provide a simple facade. That's where the abstraction actually can have value. Mm-hmm. But it should be an abstraction that you can drill further down if you want to. You can go further and you can see what actually was done. How does this machine perform the actual instantiation of that database? What is the instance size, if it was, say, Amazon, of that database that was set up? I should be able to introspect these things because those can lead to me understanding why a failure occurred in my production system or how better to architect. A good example of this is a situation that we've just recently encountered, you know, in my current universe at HashiCorp, where one of our products has a stateful, it wants to perform in a very stateful way. Well, it is a stateful application. And statefulness is a particularly tricky monster to manage. Yep. From an infrastructure standpoint, right? We really very much on the infrastructure side want to see the world as cattle, they say, not pets, right? That's a common euphemism. And so the idea that I can truly lose or blow away my infrastructure if I needed to, and that the resiliency is actually supported both at the application tier as well as other parts of the infrastructure to support the idea that any virtual thing can fail. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that whether anybody likes to think of it or not, I have a lot of experience with, virtual things fail because physical things fail. So you very much need to have that. If you, a stateful application doesn't like to operate that way, it likes to believe that there is a permanence with the thing that it's in. This is a really tricky problem with infrastructure systems. To date, if we have a full abstraction of what is actually happening on the infrastructure tier, especially when we need to version the infrastructure underneath the covers, it can be a real problem for that application team because they don't understand why systems are periodically being disconnected or broken or having any predictability around it. So as a result of that, they have to offload all of the operation problems and all of the ops that are specific to their application universe to the central infrastructure team. And that is the anti-pattern that we all want to avoid, that the whole point of DevOps was to move out of a central team operating applications in production as much as possible. So that was a long-winded answer. The short nugget here, I would say, is predictability is more valuable than velocity.
Yeah, I guess that summary helps really to understand the whole thing. Could you tell us about a particular challenge you faced working on that realm of cloud platform at HashiCorp and how you approached it?
Yeah, I'll give you a different challenge because life's full of those. When I joined HashiCorp, I joined December of 2022, so December last year. So I'm almost at my 1 year anniversary, actually. About a month and a half in, I would say. So sometime in January, all these alarms started going off. It was not my fault. I had just started. That's okay. I don't mind if it is. But it was, alarms are going off. All these, 3 a.m. things blown up. So the issue was a big portion of our system relies on a workflow. It's a workflow engine that a lot of our use cases require to be operating effectively. The engine's Cadence. It's pioneered by Uber. Temporal is maybe a more well-known modern name is the next iteration of that workflow engine. Anyway. So this thing started to blow up. And the reason it started to blow up was that it was backed by a single, very large database instance. And that database instance was struggling to keep up with an unanticipated load. And this was not necessarily a new issue. In fact, Cadence had, or rather this, nothing to say about the Cadence service. It's a perfectly fine workflow engine, but the design was just not well designed. It was not well designed to be very scalable. And so as a result, over the last several years, people had kind of wanted to avoid this system because it was known to be problematic and it had burned people out trying to support it. Mm-hmm. So, but it had finally tipped over. And by tipped over, I meant it actually stopped keeping up with the all of the workflows coming in. So it started building a history list of, I think, something on the order of maybe a million runs behind, and it was continuing to fall behind. Yeah. So, you know, when you see that, it's a downward spiral, right? And so we brought in AWS people and we formed a quick crew to set up basically like a war room situation to try to triage and stop the internal bleeding. And so what's the first thing you do? You say, okay, well, let's if we can't horizontally scale because we hadn't sharded this system, let's scale up, right? And whenever I hear scale up, I think all of us, especially in the infrastructure space, kind of cringe because, you know, there is a finite limit to scaling up. And scaling up doesn't actually solve the underlying problem, ultimately. It just delays the problem, you know. So we did. There's, again, our first focus was stop the bleeding. We scale up. It helped. Still, some things were not quite as stable as we wanted. And this is where I think the more interesting part of the story comes in. Because all these kinds of technical problems, in my whole 20-year experience, I've very rarely been on what I would consider, you know, a Mars landing kind of problem where you're maybe doing something fairly novel. And even that maybe isn't as novel anymore because we've done it before. most problems are not, in other words, insurmountable technical problems where there just is no answer. Generally, I've found that 99% of problems that I've had to deal with are more about organizational problems and, you know, you might even go to say leadership problems in the sense of how do you think about approaching this kind of crisis? What are the right things to do when a crisis like this happens? And so the steps we took, first, the very first thing is recognize that upper leadership, partners, customers who are relying on this thing all want somebody to say, I'm going to raise my hand and say, I'll take ownership of this problem. That's the very first thing everybody needs. They need to hear you say that. Mm-hmm. And so we did. I basically said, okay, we recognize this is a problem. I'm not going to make up stories about this. It's a problem and it needs to be resolved. So we're going to take ownership of it. And what we did was formed a permanent team around this. And that sent a very clear signal. We're going to own this problem. We're going to move it to a place where you can trust it. And that was actually a really important thing, not just for the ownership aspect, but there was real lack of trust in building these workflows by teams because of the instability history. And so as a result, teams started to look for alternative approaches. And that would have led to a much more complicated universe to manage. So it was very important that they knew somebody was going to own solving it. Once we did that, we defined some specific outcomes towards stability and scalability that we needed to be able to achieve. It needs to be horizontally scalable, not vertically. I think that was one of the most important things that we emphasized, that the thing we did today to band-aid this is not a solution. It's a band-aid. What we need is not to try to put all our cargo on one ship. We need multiple ships. And so once some of the fundamental, and these are not complicated concepts, but they are complicated to execute on because having multiple ships means a whole lot of additional complexity and logistics up front for figuring out what goes on those ships. And so I don't know, I just suddenly jumped into a nautical analogy, but establishing this is what we are, this is our success criteria, this is our strategy, was critical to get out early. What are the outcomes, not the physical deliverables? The next thing we had to do, deliver short-term wins. And by that, I mean, short term, what anybody ever cared about was stability in the short term, as well as enabling products to launch. So the products that were afraid to ride on this, we immediately engaged them, prioritized making sure that they were stable. They had the resources within the system to be reliable. And so we enabled those product launches. And then we pumped out every week what the reliability status was, what were there any issues, and any updates or communication on progress towards those outcomes that we had. This was critical. Those two things were vital for us to establish credibility and for people to actually feel like the wind had changed and that the ship was actually going to turn. That built confidence and trust, gave us momentum. And as we continued to execute, this team has completely revamped the architecture of the system. They've migrated a bunch of the critical systems to starting to be able to have better resource isolation, which are fundamental things in an infrastructure universe, to be able to isolate loads and manage resource consumption by each of those workloads. We didn't have some of these fundamental abilities before. Now we're in a state where we're executing on that. We've moved away from RDS and we're bringing in a scalable backend, which is, you know, a Cassandra backend, which will allow us to horizontally scale. So we're in a much different space, to the point where a leader about a week ago said to me, not only do I no longer worry about Cadence, I've basically entirely forgotten that it was ever a problem, which is great. Except that I said, just make sure that we don't think we can remove people from this team right now. I'm glad you are confident.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I believe that's very interesting, what you offer as a solution. If I put aside the technical solution, we could apply that to basically a lot of different problems that we have. Having a team that is able to say, okay, we are owners of that thing, and now we own that problem and we will solve it. Being really clear about what are the outcomes, where we are today, how we measure ourselves compared to those outcomes, that's very, very critical. And knowing that you will not win the trust of people by announcing a 24-month plan, you will win the trust of people because you are delivering something now. Getting into that mindset is critical also. So I love what you are saying about all that. Have I missed anything in what you propose?
No, I think you summarized it exceptionally well. I will say, generally, I fully agree with you. This is not a unique situation. This is a pattern and a strategy for approaching what comes up fairly often in every job I've taken. There is always a crisis, and I'm going to misquote the person, but it's what I think the famous saying is, never let a good crisis go to waste.
Exactly.
These are hugely valuable opportunities to actually have a tangible impact on the business. And, you know, where others may be afraid to tread, these are the opportunities that really enable you to shine as a leader.
I really like that. Are there other pivotal moments in your career when you really learn something significant about change and leadership?
Oh my gosh, yes. Well, first, if anything I'm saying here sounds at all polished, please understand it comes from the many battle scars that I have over my history of making mistakes and reading and learning from the wisdom of others and then having the opportunity again to apply them. But yes, let me answer your question more directly. So at Netflix, we in delivery engineering embarked on this initiative called Managed Delivery. It was a very ambitious project that is still very near and dear to my heart. It's fundamentally what it is delivery in Spinnaker is done using pipeline, basically articulating pipelines. And what we found from the way that we were operating, where every team was defining their own pipelines in Spinnaker, I think we had about 16,000 pipelines at that time. We crossed about 4,000 applications, about 400 teams was about the size we were at. Platform engineering has some challenges. One of the specific challenges was, as we were still very VM-based, as we would release new base OS MIs, that might include security improvements, patches, other things that needed to be there, we had an adoption rate of, it took on the order of months to years for certain patches or updates to be rolled out. That was really problematic for us, because you can imagine that there is, sure, I mean, if you did a security SEV1 incident, they could broadcast across the company and people might take action. But that's a pretty disruptive thing to do. What you want is a design that helps enable the bottom tier to be as evergreen as possible, right? But we had a problem. All the teams owning their own pipelines, Spinnaker had no intelligence about those pipelines. It just knew, run this. It was a workflow engine in many ways, right? Run this step. If that step gives me a green light, go to this next step, and maybe some conditional logic. But what do those steps represent? And what is the confidence after, you know, step two as to whether this new update is safe to roll out? All of that was opaque to the engineering system. So what we needed was a way that we could evolve our infrastructure and we could evolve our AMIs, we could evolve our strategies under the covers, and do so without having to get all the teams involved. So that was one of the motivations. Another motivation was we thought it would make it easier for teams to also not need to articulate or come up with strategies in their pipelines for safe delivery, right? Teams would deliver applications to multiple regions. What's the right sequence of steps that would enable you to catch a problem and roll back the change if a failure happened in, say, the second region you rolled out to, which is a very complicated problem, right? First region successful, second region fails. Most of the time pipelines would just die. And now you have this very confusing universe where you have different versions of your software running and problems can surface. Yeah. So we thought, hey, let's take that problem away from teams too. Let's create a declarative form of delivery that basically enables people to define the criteria for success that would enable promotion from one lower environment to higher environments. That was essentially the goal of managed delivery, was move them towards the description of what needed to happen as opposed to defining how it should happen. Mm-hmm. Very ambitious on the size that I was mentioning, especially because Netflix culture very much operated with a freedom and responsibility concept. And so that meant that teams were never really obligated to use a service or a new system. So imagine operating in an environment where you have lots of very smart and talented people from all around the world that are working on their problems, their projects, and you ask them, you need to engage them on something that they honestly would prefer to not really have to think about. Right. The water company doesn't reach out to me to talk about repiping, you know, pipes to my house. Like, I have no interest in that conversation. If you need to do it, sure, go ahead. Right. It's the same way in delivery engineering and reaching out to these teams. I don't know. My software always continues to deliver. It's fine. Why do I need to care about this? This is a very common problem in platform engineering, but also a common problem for library producers, API producers, anybody that's producing something that others are consuming. Yep. You almost always have more interest in making that happen than they do, especially when the value proposition may be more on one side than the other. And that was the key mistake I made at that time. You know, we very much wanted to take the approach of if we built something really valuable and very interesting for folks, they would adopt it. And I think there was merit to that. And so we spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, the early adopters, we got some early successes, we got some people to enjoy it. But then we hit that classic crossing the chasm problem, where we couldn't get past the early innovators to the early adopters. And we struggled on that. What was it? Was it some combination of features? Was it some combination of capabilities? Something that this could do that other things couldn't? What I miscalculated personally was the actual value to the business was the platform engineering side of the equation. Platform engineering needed to see this adopted across the fleet for there to be real value. And so given that, the strategy may not necessarily be one of slow adoption, but rather it may be more important to take a little bit stronger of an approach. And John Cotter talks about this he has an article in HBR called Leading Change, but he has a book called Why Transformations Fail. Mm-hmm. I will say I read that book during that time and I failed in probably at least the top three, even after I read it. So I will tell you, there is a very, I learned how big the gap is between knowledge and wisdom and that gap being how wide experience needs that gap, which is experience is that gap, right? And how much of that you actually need. Long story short, you know, managed delivery's value proposition very much is alive. It is moving forward. But that was an experience where I realized because our adoption was very slow, you could imagine that we did not take as an aggressive of an approach. Specifically, by aggressive, I mean, we didn't establish a sense of urgency. So teams were necessarily complacent in the adoption. And it's not no fault to them. That's the way the culture was designed to operate. But as a result, it's getting adoption, getting that change to actually happen, it was much harder. Now, I know that they are doing amazing stuff now over there in terms of growing it. We've learned a lot of those lessons. And the impact of that approach is really being felt. In fact, years later, I landed at HashiCorp. My peer came from Samsung SmartThings, and he recognized me and said, oh, you know, managed delivery. And they apparently a larger footprint than Netflix, much higher traffic than Netflix. All the IoT devices, right, call into their systems. Yeah. And they overnight, basically, maybe it's not quite overnight, but they fully adopted it and saw some of the benefits of that adoption as a result. And so it was a cathartic to hear, or comforting rather to hear. But yes, it was a good experience in the challenges of change.
Yeah, yeah. It's very interesting that we are going back to that idea of a team owns a problem and now tries to solve it. Unfortunately, it's really a problem for the business, but it's not necessarily a problem for the other teams that are consuming something yes. from that team. And now, how do you create a sense of urgency for the other team when they are not even aware that it's really a problem for the business? And you cannot count on that for them to investigate that part. So maybe the other nudge to go there.
Well, and I have a story about creating the urgency because one of the things I learned. There's actually two pieces to that I learned and I applied at the next job, actually, after I left Hashi, after I left Netflix. It was a mid-tier company. We were on the entire fleet was on a Heroku, actually. We were hitting problems with that form, going back to the ability to introspect and understand how things work. Mm-hmm. Heroku was too abstract, too high level for us to be able to operate it effectively for the things that we wanted to be able to do. You know, it got us the 0 to 1, but that hard abstraction made it impossible for us to get past that 1. Long story short, though, we needed to migrate. We needed to migrate off. But even with that, we want to migrate off. Like all things that happen in a business, they are good goals. They're set, like you said, the 24-month goal. Oh, yes, we should be here. But how important is that? How urgent is that? This is, from my experience with managed delivery, this is what I learned. Okay, so two things. One, you need a sense of urgency. So how do we create that urgency? You need to get a date set. And that date needs to have consequences. So we talked specifically about setting a 9-month target from the point that I had started that job. And the reason for 9 months is 9 months feels close enough that it will happen, mm-hmm. but far enough away that virtually no engineering team says no, right? And I mean this very much affectionately. We all believe that the world is possible in 9 months, not 3 months, but 9 months, yes. 9 months, I for sure will have time. So we got alignment that in 9 months, we would hit this target. But we made sure that the other aspect of this was we were going to shut off Heroku. We were going to actually disable and tear up the contract. And so that was the cliff date. Mm-hmm. That's great to have that date. And there's a lot to unpack on the importance of setting dates. But the other bit that was vital was we needed to get executive alignment with that. That needed to be something that the executives would back. And by that, I mean, you know, the term leadership or executives is nebulous. Just someone in a position of authority at the right level that can basically say, once you get to that 3 months away from landing this, that this is a date that will not move. And we were able to get that. And those two things ensured that that project, very ambitious. We moved the entire fleet out and over to Azure, and we had zero service disruption. It was a remarkable feat. The team did an amazing job, but I truly believe having both of those factors enabled us to do that Herculean task, because the last three months, you can imagine, were brutal, stressful. You know, we bought lots of DoorDash for people and supported them as they were executing on all of this stuff. But once we landed that, the entire crew could look back, and they did. And said this was an amazing thing we were able to accomplish. And there was real pride with being able to do it. So very good lessons learned.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And once again, that's really interesting to unpack the learnings about that. Yeah, you need a date. And when people hear that, they can hear that, yeah, that's a date, but maybe we can be late. And no, that's really a cliff. There's nothing behind. And you need that support, that alignment. So nobody will dare to change the date. There's no option around that. And that's absolutely clear for everybody. So now they can make plans. They have the time.
9 months is a good one. I was thinking, it's feasible. And then you know nothing about it. I realized that when you were saying it, that if you would have said 3 months, I would have said, oh no, that I would have started to think why it was not possible. But 9 months, I was comfortable to say, yeah, okay. And I knew nothing about the challenge, the reality of the challenge. It's very funny. So yeah, you can start making plans. That's a good one.
That's right.
What would be your advice to emerging leaders who want to make a meaningful impact?
The first thing I would say is you need to understand your stakeholders. I have learned the enormous value in developing those relationships and deeply understanding who your customers are, who your peers are, and what leadership is expecting of your organization. A lot of people, I think, focus, especially emerging leaders, they focus on their team and down. I have a lot of experience in doing that and failing beautifully because I misunderstood what was expected, what was not spoken but expected by my peers and by upper leadership. And so you really need to understand not just the surface statements of here's our goals, here's our outcomes. What you want to ask is what keeps you up at night? You want to ask where things have failed in the past. You want to hear the chins more than you want to hear the thoughtful process of desires, right? It's those emotional reactions, those small perceptions of your team and of what is expected of your organization that actually will affect whether or not you are successful, because those are the micro perceptions that actually determine whether they're going to think of your team as a team to rely upon for those next strategic steps that they want to take. Right. So understand them very well. And that takes a lot of time. And there's great books on this. But this is where it truly is around the psychological approach far more than it is that technical execution or delivery. The next one is you need to deliver wins within the first 90 days of starting a new job. And there is a great book, First 90 Days. I think it's a fantastic book on this topic. I've applied it and successfully a few times now. It very much is correct. Get that win. You have to have credibility. When you go into a room, you have to be able to be believed when you say we should do X or Y. Otherwise, you're going to stay in the tactical level always because you haven't established that you can actually solve bigger problems. The key thing with getting that credibility in the first 90 days is you don't need a big win. You just need something meaningful, something that addresses a concern. Peers of mine had actually mentioned this to me years before too. Don't try to run after the biggest thing you can run after, especially when you first start. Start with something you can own and influence. So it's something within your control. Don't do something that's going to require a bunch of other folks to be aligned, especially when you first start. It's challenging to do that. So it should be something, for the most part, you can control. Second part, it's got to be something that matters to other people. It doesn't really matter what it is. It doesn't have to be a technical solution. It could be an organizational solution. It could be an information solution. It could be a communication solution. It could be any of these things. But it needs to be something that actually addresses a fear or concern. A great example of this is just starting a monthly newsletter for your organization and ensuring that the rest of the business understands even what your team does or your group does. That's surprisingly a big problem in many places. It's just the awareness factor. And doing that suddenly puts you on the radar of a lot of people, and it can really move things forward. That's not a technical problem at all.
Yeah.
But it is a problem, and it can establish you. The third thing that emerging leaders need to be taking a look at to have real meaningful impact, define the purpose for your team. And by that, I mean you need to bring your team into that. But defining a purpose is one of the most fundamentally powerful actions that I have ever learned to take with my team. And purpose is different from mission and vision. A purpose it lives the lifetime of that team or that group that you are managing. And a purpose is not, sometimes it's referred to as a North Star. I don't think it's not quite that right way of seeing it. A purpose just establishes a philosophy that everything stems from. So one of my favorite examples of this was, I think he was a gosh, and the name is going to slip out of my mind, but he was a French designer, actually, I think, that helped establish the purpose for Disneyland. Mm-hmm. And that purpose was to create happiness in the visitors. Now, if you think about that, that sounds very simple, but it's a very powerful fulcrum. Because at that point, when you have that, everything from how you name the parking lots, you name them after Mickey and Goofy, not A and B and C, the design of the trash cans, the uniforms, the decision to have very pleasing flower beds that are millions and millions of dollars of investment for each of these things. Why do you do that? Because each of these pieces maybe makes somebody smile a little bit more. Establishing a purpose for your organization enables you to prioritize. It gives your teams freedom to execute and to think more broadly. And it enables you to align with what your next strategic steps need to be. It really is the guiding, you can think of it as a guiding principle. So I've written articles on this, but there's much better, smarter minds than mine that have spoken on this topic.
I will link to that and we will let people decide about that. So what's next for you? Any exciting projects or initiatives you want to share?
Yeah. So, well, with HashiCorp, I think one of the exciting things that we have coming up next from the platform engineering organization is really trying to crack this self-service nut. You know, HashiCorp is an organization that has, we build tools for infrastructure management, right? I mean, we build tools for platform engineering. How do we leverage all of the tools that we have and the patterns and behaviors that we want to encourage to enable self-service within our organization? So a team being able to go from zero to one. I know this is a nut that a lot of people have cracked in the sense of they've created, you know, IDPs, right, in internal developer platforms. But I think that that's more of a how. And I think I want to get back to, again, the principles. What are we caring about enabling? The actual day one problem of give me a service is not a hard problem to solve. It's been solved a lot. The day two problem of, now I want to add a database to my service. That's a harder problem. And that's one of the ones I'm excited to see get moved forward. Yeah. So that's I'm looking forward to that next year.
That's very cool. So let's talk again. Thank you very much, Michael, for joining. Have fun solving that.
Thank you, Alexis.